John, we're standing in the main gallery at the ICA with your recent works around the walls. The pieces we've got here are large diptychs, photographs printed onto stretched canvas. Could you just tell me exactly what processes are involved in producing the images?
Well, it's not a conventional photographic print process in that the material itself is not a photographically sensitized material. And this really is the point, or part of the point, of doing them like this. That what that means is you're enabled to contemplate a size within a single sheet, which simply would not be permitted by the use of existing photographic papers. What it also allows is the consideration of a kind of surface quite different to photographic surface. And in this case, the surfaces are absolutely matte, very, very flat, so that your awareness of the surface itself is very pronounced. There are a number of other things. One is, for example, that, of course, most of these are in colour, and the inks which comprise the image are much more stable than photographic dyes. There is something else which this allows, particularly the surface, I think, and then also the medium that's being used, which is a form of address of the image, which is quite distinct from the conventional address of the photo, which is traditionally like a little window on the world that you look into. These pictures, you're required to look not just into, but very much to look at. The address is very confrontational in nature. But I also wanted, as part of that confrontational positioning of the spectator, a situation comparable to that of experiencing something like a large billboard in the street, or comparable even to watching the cinema screen. And there is some referral of these images to that kind of iconography.
And another, I suppose, obvious reference that would be made, simply in terms of their status as stretched canvas with colour on them, would be to contemporary painting. Now, I know in the catalogue that you seem to play that kind of reference down as opposed to the one that we've just been talking about.
Well, first of all, I would say clearly there is a relationship to be made, and I wouldn't deny it. Perhaps if I'd not given much emphasis to that, from my own position, the need to make images on this scale and even to present them in this way was not to do with trying to make an association with painting. In fact, insofar as that association might have been made, it was intended to be made possibly even in a negative way, by which I mean as the presentation of an alternative mode of image production, nevertheless within the general field in which this activity of painting takes place. The choice of a fabric to print onto is the logical choice. I think it's really a question of attempting to show that one can produce static visual images that do, by their very nature, continue the tradition of paint on canvas, without losing many of the properties that that easel painting convention has acquired over a long period of time, but taking into account all the changes in image production in accord with changing technology that have taken place over the last 150 years.
Could we then go on and talk about some of the things we have here? The general scheme in all these images seems to be that there is one static element within the image and one moving element, and that the two images which make up the diptych are comprised of one in which the camera itself was static, so the moving element is blurred, as in this one we're looking at, which has a woman, a young woman, sitting on a sofa taking off her stocking. She's in her underwear, and an older man in the foreground in a rocking chair. The image on the left has the woman in focus and the man blurred, and the right hand image, it seems, is taken with the camera moving in the same way as the rocking chair, so we see the older man clearly, or certainly more clearly than in the left hand image, and the young woman in the background is now completely blurred.
It's a strategy of image production which most of the works in this exhibition have used, and then some of the most recent works have used a different notion which revolves around the production of a negative image. But both of those actually refer to not just something which has highly photographic associations and which seems to be very much part and parcel of the depictive language of photography. Blurring, of course, we think of very much within this relation. And the negative, we also do, but of course each has their physiological counterpart in actual optical experience. And if you do move your head swiftly in front of something, or move something swiftly in front of your eyes, you do register a blur, the experience of blur. If you are exposed to a bright flash of light reflected from objects, which is then rapidly removed, you experience what we call the afterimage, which is a negative image, and in terms of colour, which provides the sense of complementary colour experience. So these aspects of seeing and of representation are things that do have their counterpart in the world of first-hand perception. But nevertheless, these two things particularly, blur, negativity, are things that we associate very particularly with the medium of photography. So, if you like, there is a kind of equivalence between part of the experience of seeing itself and the fact of photographic rendition. The work that you're talking of, which is called Tempo, is, like many of the works in this exhibition, in fact, if you like, I think perhaps like all the works in this exhibition, is in effect two views of the same moment. But there's also, in juxtaposing them side by side, as I've done, as it were, a new picture, which is the confluence of the two, which is, strictly speaking, an impossible picture, but one which gives a larger view of this single event than either in turn are capable of doing, but which also gives a distinct view of the same event. And I think the idea is that in isolation, each of these two images have a quite different set of associations. The girl who is actually putting on the stocking, although it is an ambiguous picture, and deliberately so, getting dressed in a domestic interior, seemingly alone, is not an extraordinary event. It's a fairly innocuous, everyday occurrence in itself. The man in the rocking chair, seemingly fairly old, wearing pajamas, a dressing gown, he's got a blanket over his knees, I would have thought would have connotations of age of resting, dozing, possibly of sickness, recuperation. So the intended connotations are quite distinct. It's only when you see them together that there's almost a wrench, as it were, between these two connotations. And suddenly there's a sexual component injected, the implication of a relationship at that level between the old man and the young girl, which of course is particularly wrenching in that it also transgresses something of a taboo involving sexuality between people who are so separated by age. I think my primary concerns are the kind of things that I've talked about, which are concerns about what artists can do, what kind of images they can construct in relation to reality, what kind of media they can use to do this job at this point in time, what kind of accommodation can be made for this kind of work. They for me are quite fundamental concerns, and in a sense the specific images chosen and the specific related image contexts that they point to are secondary issues. If that makes sense. I mean, for example, this work called Exchange, which is seemingly about an exchange of the gaze between a man and a woman, between a woman driving rapidly past a male pedestrian. So there's not just an exchange of glances, there's even an exchange of normal roles according to a certain stereotyping of objectification. The woman is very powerfully located here. She's driving a powerful car. She's moving, which would normally be the position of the male figure in this, according to a certain stereotypical placing between male and female in this sort of context. She's also behind the window of the car, whereas the male is much more passively located, and so on. This kind of subject is, of course, it's very foregrounded, but even then, I would say it follows from what for me is an even more basic subject, which is the subject of representation itself, insofar as it deals with a kind of voyeurism, that very interest is stemming from an interest in that facet of the medium itself. And insofar as it deliberately uses this moving sheet of glass, this moving flat sheet of glass, as a surface which allows these two different images to be construed, it's very important to me that the flatness of that surface is in parallel, quite literally in this case, with the flat sheet of the plane of the photographic surface.
Right, shall we just go down to the small gallery at the end and see the work down there? In some ways these are similar to the larger works we've just seen. They're cibachromes. They're much smaller than the works on fabric. They're much closer to the kinds of imagery, simply in terms of look and formal qualities, that you're perhaps commenting upon.
Yes, I think probably we were talking before about glossiness, and I was saying you can use this term both literally and figuratively. And in this case, one can use it both literally and figuratively, so that any reference to glossy magazine images is made much more explicit here, so that the danger, as it were, of mistaking the intended critique as merely endorsement is much greater. And there is, I would admit, an ambivalence about this work, because, again, as I said before, it's not just that it seeks to perform a rather suspicious critique in relation to its medium, but at the same time, it's a declaration of respect, of love, of celebration of this medium. So I may well be suspicious of the ethics of, let's say, Benson and Hedges advertisements, but at the same time, I have enormous respect for the creativity, the invention, the imagery which results, and I'm very interested every time a new one appears. And obviously that doesn't just relate to Benson and Hedges ads, but it relates much more broadly than that. So I think just to see these things as being fairly narrowly polemical would be quite wrong. I think I may be criticised for dealing with these things, perhaps, and not dealing with them in a more complete sense. But then that's not really my purpose. I think my purpose is to try and identify and deal with a number of different kinds of elements which relate to the use of this medium in particular, which relate to the production of art objects in general, and bring them all together. And I think if you're trying to do that, then it wouldn't be possible to take one of these particular subjects and foreground it in a way which it seems there is some expectation that one should be doing. And, you know, I've had particular problems with allowing myself to address myself to a subject like the objectification of women in pictures. And of course, in the end, you know, the bottom line of the argument always is that in order to discuss this subject, the only way to avoid its pitfalls is not to yourself be using comparable images in performing that kind of critique. Now, at that point, I would have an argument. I would be in dispute with that bottom line. But nevertheless, I do acknowledge it as being a problem. And to the extent that I've tried, insofar as I've continued to incorporate that kind of objectification as subject, I have tried to do it in a way which avoids that misconstruction. And the way that particular subject is dealt with in the images on fabric, I think, doesn't draw criticism in the same way. And perhaps because, as you say, they then do diverge in their form considerably from the sources they refer to. And perhaps also because I've rethought the way that, from my own standpoint, I could legitimately be using images of that kind. So the way they've been selected, the way they've been deployed, I think is rather different. And I think the way I talked about the use of the man and the woman in this piece called Exchange is a very good example of that.
Don't know nothing about politics. Don't know nothing about economics. Don't know nothing about the Trilateral Commission. Don't know nothing about Reagan's position. But I do know that art and politics don't mix. But I do know that art and politics don't mix. What a wonderful world it would be if they did. What a wonderful world it would be if they did.
Nothing in particular, but lots of different things. Little things, bits and pieces, always lying low. Feel so much better about you now. In my fingers, your substance has the last easy texture of gray shades. Oh, now they're whiter in the headlights. coming out of the dusk, holding up to the bonfire. Nothing in particular, but lots of different things, little things, bits and pieces. And the voice catches on that old familiar line of the camp song, and we put it in its place. I feel so much better about you now.
Es sind nur 11. Volle Schießerei in Tripoli.
I'm talking. Panama, c'est la belle vie. Rabbi Blanca, rabbit pour qui? Et ne voyant dans les suburbs de Panama que la fiesta, la feria, les barbaïs, monopolis, la tambola, la bombola, la bamboula, barbapapa, Rabbi Blanca, exit pour qui? Le canal à Nivel del Mar était un écocide. Même pour 5.300 millions de dollars, les eaux du Pacifique ne pouvaient s'allier à celles de l'Atlantique sans que malheur de faune s'en suive. Mais qui en avait cours à l'Isla del Canto? Rabbi Blanqui, Rablanc, pour qui? Et puis, tous ces coups, les disturbos, les protestas, les golpissas, non par désenchantement, mais parce que 1 plus 1 égalait encore 2, et que les Santa Cruz des Amériques latines...
Well, there's a dense fog here on the waterfront in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and that foghorn is on a ferry going over to Dartmouth, which is across the river. This report from Nova Scotia College of Art and Design starts with an extract of David Bartow's video arcade music, and after Jerry Ferguson, a sound work by Micah Lexia. Jerry, you've been here at Nova Scotia College of Art since 1968, and of course since then Nova Scotia has become extremely well known throughout the world for its publications, contemporary art publications, and for its visiting arts program. And perhaps, you know, we could start by you talking about the background of the college and how the programs actually, such as the publishing program and the visiting artists program, actually came into being.
When I came to the college in 68, it was evident that because of a limited community support for the programs that we had in mind here, that we were going to need, you know, considerable, you know, stimulation. So one of the things that we decided was the allocation of a faculty salary for visitors to rotate, you know, a number of people through as stimulus to both students and faculty, so that that sense of isolation that the faculty felt and that the students would inevitably, you know, realize could be overcome. But we didn't want to do it based upon our own just common sense and previous experience in a kind of conventional visiting artist fashion, where somebody is brought in, they give a lecture, they're given their few hundred dollars, and then they leave. One thing that we thought should occur, if it's going to really be meaningful, is to have some kind of quid pro quo, to have them want to come here in a way that would also be a benefit to them, not just come in for their extra $100, but actually be able to, as it were, get some work done. So the availability of whatever facilities we might have available for the production of their own work, which is to say, you know, video or sound work or anything of that kind, would certainly be made available, you know, to visitors, not just as demonstrations for students, but a place where they could actually produce work. I mean, Dan Graham, Vito Conchi, Dennis Oppenheim, early on, I mean, used video and sound facilities for the making of works that they were doing, which were not maybe readily available, you know, to them in other circumstances. What we decided to do in 68 was to establish also a professional lithography workshop, which would give an opportunity for artists to come here and actually do work that would then feed back into the marketplace, which would benefit them economically, but as well give them an opportunity to engage in a situation which hitherto they had not had that opportunity to engage in. Basically, we were dealing with artists who wouldn't be conventionally associated with that kind of, well, almost an anachronistic kind of production in relation to their sort of almost avant-garde, you know, kind of pose, such as, you know, Dennis Oppenheim, Vito Conchi, Dan Graham, etc. We did the first major lithographic production, which made a considerable amount of sense with drawing from instructions, you know, Saul LeWitt, and any number of other people. This continued until about 1975. So rather than continue that, it was thought more interesting to, you know, enter into a series of publications, namely books, not book works, not the work of art in book form, which had been dealt with previously, such as, you know, Larry Wiener unable to do the lithograph, we published, you know, a small book as part of a lithography workshop, not as part of the press, but to deal with, like, books that would be involved with source materials in contemporary arts.
And so in many senses, the college had a kind of catalytic effect in relation to certainly art in the early 70s, it would seem.
It is fair to say that the college, you know, at least assisted, if not, you know, acted in a kind of catalytic fashion for some kinds of production. But one also has to remember in the late 60s and early 70s, the kind of material base for production was geared away from, you know, conventional studio practice. I mean, Andre described himself as the first post-studio artist. Many people were producing in a manner that allowed them to, you know, be mobile, not studio-bound, you know, for their activity. And sort of have idea will travel, you know, was not an unusual, you know, kind of situation. So fortuitously, the college was able to contribute to but yet benefit from that particular historical moment.
I like him. I like him a lot. He's very handsome.
One.
Two. He's very good looking.
Three.
Four. He's very handsome.
Five. Six.
He's very good looking.
Seven.
He's very handsome.
Nine.
He is intelligent.
Ten.
Who is he? Who is he? Who is he?
He is a lawyer.
Who is he?
He's a farmer.
Who is he?
He's an architect.
Who is he?
He's a teacher.
Who is it?
He's a doctor.
Who is it?
He's at the university.
Who is it?
He's a university professor.
Who is it?
He's a worker.
Well, I'm talking now to Bruce Barber, who's the coordinator of the Intermedia section at Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. Yesterday, Bruce, I spoke to Jerry Ferguson about the college as a whole, about the visiting artist program, about the reputation it built up and established over the last, 15 to 20 years now. But you are the coordinator of the Intermedia program at the college, so perhaps you could actually explain a little bit about how that works, what its philosophy is and what its structure is.
Well, the Intermedia department is a separate, identifiable department within the studio division, and we have a structured course from the introductory to the intermediate level prior to students going on to the studio level, where more open, kind of independent working processes expected of the students. So the given mandate or the assumed mandate of the intermediate department, which is fairly well known throughout the school, is that it's critical and that it follows within the avant-garde tradition of art making, art producing, art criticism, art experiencing, and so on. No matter how defunct we might wish to believe that tradition is at this particular point in time, we feel that it's important for students to come to an understanding of the tradition within which they're working and the alternatives that the historical avant-garde has presented to the firmly tradition-based disciplines, sculpture, painting, and the like. In a sense, it's very like many of the intermediate departments or media departments in the East Coast colleges, which NASCAD is part of, a kind of a network where we share students, and often we get students at the intermediate level, transfer students, or at the advanced level who work solely in say, video, and they have the opportunity to do that. So usually the introductory course, as I said, concentrates on sound work, Super 8 film, photo-related works, and then moves on to video. So there is, while I've emphasized technology, that doesn't necessarily mean to say that the emphasis is solely technical. There's a lot of theoretical and critical work that's undertaken in the college as a whole, and its locus of attention, if I can be really biased, I think occurs within the intermediate department.
All in all,
it's a pleasure and a privilege.
Right to the core, or is it only skin deep? All in all,
it's a pleasure and a privilege.
I just can't deal with all the activity.
You're a kook.
All in all,
it's a pleasure and a privilege.
Does it go right to the core, or is it only skin deep? All in all,
I just can't deal with all the negativity.
It's a pleasure and a privilege.
You're a kook.
Does it go right to the core, or is it only skin deep?
Pleasure and a privilege.
I just can't deal with all the negativity.
All in all,
you're a
pleasure and privilege.
Does it go right to the core, or is it only skin deep? All in all,
it's a pleasure and a privilege.
And I just can't deal with all the negativity.
You're a kook.
Does it it go right to the core, or is it only skin deep?
About.
And I just can't deal with all the negativity.
About 20 years ago?
You're a kook.
About 20 years ago?
Does it go right to the core, or is it only skin deep?
And I just can't deal with all the negativity.
Years ago? About.
You're a
20
kook.
Years ago? About 20 years ago? About 20 years ago? About 20 years ago? About 20 years ago?
Hello, is this your first time? Christopher Halbert. You didn't see me and my. Well, Halbert's one.
You didn't see me.
Oh, is this your first time? Christopher Halbert.
Places.
It is.
Life has been fruitful here.
My. Well. Halbert's one.
From other places. From other places. From other places.
Is this your Christopher Halbert?
From other places.
And, my. Well. Halbert's one.
Fruitful here.
It is indeed. And,
from other places.
So, oh, is this your first trip to Halifax?
I am
here. Indeed. My. Halifax one.
I want beer. I want beer. I want beer. I want beer.
That sound work titled Visitor-Resident Collaboration was produced by Dan Lander. Following my visit to the college, tape loops were exchanged to produce that work in Canada and the next piece in London.
Now, CJCH News at 9 o'clock. Good morning. I'm Doug Reynolds. Yesterday's separation of Siamese twins in Toronto was successful. Toronto was successful. It was a 17-hour operation.
Matt's been transected.
To separate Lynn and Wynn to the
firm.
Pleasure.
Small, large intestines were separated.
So one of the boys had to become a girl.
Has one leg. The bone from a third leg. Described as wasted or atrophic. Atrophic. That's the true bony pelvis was divided.
The quiet halls of Toronto's hospital for sick children.
After the operation last night.
Now, Mike Alexia drives from Halifax across the suspension bridge to Radio Q104 in Dartmouth. Doug Berrin, a presenter at Q104, provides the link back to Halifax and the conversation with Ingrid Koenig at the Eye Level Gallery, and final music by Follop Willing, PA.
We're probably quite near the radio station, but just talking a little bit about the town itself, because it's a very beautiful town. We've just come over the suspension bridge, and this morning, in fact, it was there was dense fog at the waterfront. I had a sort of walk round, but now it's, you know, very bright sunshine. I mean, what about the town itself? Because it's quite a small town, although it's a mixture of modern and old and so on. I mean, you can actually get around it quite easily. It's relatively small in scale.
Yeah, it's an interesting town for in terms of, I'm talking about Halifax, not Dartmouth. Yeah, because it's really teeny in a lot of ways, and everyone, all students walk everywhere. Everything's within walking distance. And it's got a really tight art community that is the same community as the colleges. So it's all one. There's no such thing as, like, the university community and then this like professional artist community.
I mean, one of the things about Halifax too is that people apply here from all over Canada, and when they come here, presumably they really come here to work. I mean, I was interested to discover that the college, for instance, is open 24 hours a day, so people can work there day and night, weekends and so on, if they wish.
Oh, right. The students here, because they're from other places, I think because they don't have families and those same kind of commitments, their families are made up of other art students. So when your family's made up of other art students, you're talking about art things all the time, and it's a much more concentrated. You're living with it even more than if, let's say, you were living at home and you had to go home and talk about, your mom complains about your clothes or something. You don't have those same kind of family things. It's all art, all most of the time, and your family's made up of these other art students or the other art professors. So it's fairly intense in that way as well.
In fact, what we didn't mention earlier is that we're in Dartmouth now, which is on the other side of the river.
Dartmouth is like the twin city to Halifax. It's much more residential, much more small town. It has maybe one building, which is one large building, which is the building that the radio station is in that we're going to.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go to
Dartmouth.
Life is a ball when you're at the mall or anywhere at all in
Dartmouth. Litter on the sidewalk where the signs are getting bitty. Don't let folks across the way say Dartmouth's not a city. How can you lose? People's jewelers, people's lunch. There's even people's Green Gables. When you want to munch, come to Dartmouth.
It's nice to be right here.
Dartmouth.
Let's get a case of beer.
Dartmouth.
Everything's waiting for
Dartmouth.
You.
I've been living here for 97 years, and I gotta tell you, they make the best darn fish and chips in the world in Dartmouth.
Roy Tender, and I'm living in Dartmouth, and I'm some happy you.
I'm going down to Belmont and pick myself up some Dartmouth men.
Hey, Ed, what are you up to?
Driving around the rotary, Bob.
Hey, perfect.
How can you lose? People's jewelers, people's lunch. There's even people's Green Gables when you want to munch down in Dartmouth.
It's nice to be right here.
Well, now I'm in the Eye Level Gallery here in Halifax with Ingrid Koenig, who works here periodically, who's here today for this conversation. Ingrid, you were in fact a student, were you not, at Nova Scotia College of Art and Design?
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you left there?
I graduated from the master's program this past spring and then was unemployed because we have a teacher's assistantship program in the college so that you can be eligible for unemployment. And then the UIC, Unemployment Insurance Corporation, has this new employment development program. So that's how a few of us got hired. You have to be on UIC and then your wages get, a bit become raised a bit through this kind of work in your field.
I was wondering if students actually, having finished here at the college, and I know that a lot of the students are from what are called the maritime districts, but mm-hmm. also people come here from all over Canada, mm-hmm. When they've finished their education here, I mean, do they tend to stay? I mean, are you going to stay in Halifax or mm-hmm. are you going to go?
Well, it's quite a transient city in terms of art students and artists. They don't usually stay. Some students will get hired for a summer stint to teach the graduate program, from the graduate program. But in general, there isn't much here to stay with, unfortunately. I mean, it would be great, because it's a wonderful city.
We have no quarrel with you, the Soviet people. Please understand. The world believes no government has a right to shoot civilian airliners out of the sky. We have no quarrel with you, the Soviet people. Please understand, the world believes no government has a right to shoot civilian airliners out of the sky. We have no quarrel with you, the Soviet people. Please understand, the world believes no government has a right to shoot civilian airliners out of the sky. Just as government censorship is a barrier to understanding, the inflexibility of the Soviet government on arms control is holding back successful negotiations.